Good morning, and thanks for joining us for Behind the Headlines, your weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. We've got a packed show today. A proposal that would limit reporters' access to the Senate floor advances at the legislature. Homeless advocates call for a shelter to serve the elderly and infirm. The push to prevent public employers from punishing a worker for having a medical cannabis card. And Salt Lake City native, will be bringing home a gold medal from the Beijing Olympics. Joining me for this conversation on the Zoom, we've got Salt Lake Tribune State Watch reporter Kim Bohorquez. And Kim, thank you very much for joining us this morning. The second week running. Thanks.
Happy to be here.
Of course. Government reporter Bethany Rogers, welcome to you as well.
Thanks, Roger.
Glad you're here. And George Pyle, editorial page editor and columnist. Good morning to you. Grateful for your time.
Good morning.
A little bit later on the show as well, you will hear from Tribune Olympics reporter Julie Jag, all the way from Beijing. And as always, listeners, you can join the show with your questions and comments. Call us up at 801-355-8255 or name check us on Twitter. Our handle is at KCPW. Let's start with something that we tackled a little bit last week. And so this will be kind of an update. It's a proposal to change the rules on media access to lawmakers and kind of news about the news here itself. Kim, on Wednesday, there was a hearing on this measure. And, you know, actually, just before we tackle the hearing, for anyone who missed last week's show, can you just remind us what this rule change would do? I know it has two parts.
Yeah, so this rules resolution proposed by Senator Mike McKell would do two things. First, it would require credentialed reporters to get permission from a Senate official to enter the Senate floor during recess to interview a lawmaker. And the second thing that it would do is that it also prevents reporters, including videographers and photographers, from standing behind a committee room's dais without the permission of a committee chair.
And the dais is, again, just the sort of podium there, the place where the chair sits, I guess. I always want to clarify the term because it's one of those old terms that we have. This is a proposal by Senator Mike McKell. Was there some incident, some specific reason for this rule change that he was pointing to? Or I guess, what is the justification for making this change in rules?
Since the proposal of this rules change, lawmakers have admitted that while there really hasn't been many cases where it's been an issue, they are bringing it up to codify rules and to make the rule clear for reporters. So that they can continue to do their work and that they're not interrupted is what they have said.
Okay. There was a hearing on Wednesday, as I said, in that Senate committee on this proposal. And I'm wondering if you might just tell us basically what happened at that hearing, Kim. Who was there, who testified, and then get us to the vote.
Yeah, so it was a cramped committee room. There were several media outlets that came to speak out against the rules change. And at times, between lawmakers and reporters, the debate got pretty heated. But something that did come out of that meeting, even though the committee did end up approving the rules change, mm-hmm. is the need for a Capitol Press Corps organization, which is something that you'll find in DC or in other state houses, where lawmakers, legislators, and media outlets will negotiate media access rules and even handle the press credentialing process.
Hmm. And yeah, as you said, I mean, the packed committee room, there were a lot of media outlets representatives of media outlets and organizations who had people there testifying in opposition to this rules change. This the idea of a Capitol Press Corps, was that something that, you know, got included in this rules change? Is that something that will just come together later? Maybe we'll wrap up here pretty soon on this, as we talked about it last week. But tell us more about the Capitol Press Corps and when or how that might come together.
Yeah, I mean, that Capitol Press Corps organization, it wasn't included in the rules change ultimately, but the committee chair, Senator Bramble said that he was really open to having future discussions, you know, to talk about that and to possibly create something like that. However, in the meantime, he said that it was important to have boundaries and rules that everyone understands, and that's why the committee ended up ruling in favor of the rules change.
And it was there was just one dissenting vote in the committee, a 7-1 vote. I don't know if this matters or not. I noticed that it wasn't a partisan split. There was one Democrat who voted for this rule change, as opposed to it being, you know, all Republicans, all Democrats. We'll move past this shortly, but where does this go? And I guess, ironically enough, this is headed to the Senate floor, right? That's where it's going to be heard next?
Yeah, so it's headed to the Senate for further discussion and consideration. And you're right, it wasn't a party line vote. We did have a Democratic senator, Gene Davis, vote against it. Yeah. And Senator Main, she voted for it because she really appreciated the discussion, the very necessary discussion that happened in that room between lawmakers and journalists about media access rules.
Okay.
And she, you know, she supported further debate on the topic, which is why she voted for it.
Got it. We will see, you know, what happens to it at the Senate. George Pyle, there's still some more hurdles for this measure to jump through as well. You know, it's got to go to the House. I guess I won't ask you to make any predictions, but what do you see in this measure by Senator McKell?
Well, I think it's clear that this is a done deal now that the Republicans in the Senate want to do that. I'd probably never pass up an opportunity to meet the press. It's unfortunate. I mean, they did hear us out at the committee meeting, and they did engage. They weren't able to do, as far as I was able to see, and I wasn't there, but is explain why they thought this was necessary. The press isn't down there on the floor of the Senate while they're debating, while they're voting. The idea is that when they stop and are about to scatter to their committee rooms and offices, we have the working press, the reporters have a chance to walk up to individual senators and ask them about bills that they're in the process of considering, and ask them why, what's the reason for this. And those are things that the people should know and should have an opportunity to know. And the view from just a little bit away from this is that the Senate doesn't like to have to explain itself to the people through the press. They want to be able to just do whatever it is they do, and it's none of anybody else's business.
Kim, I said something that I'm wondering if you can clarify for me. I introduced George, I said that this would have to go through the House as well. Is that true for a rules change in the Senate, or is it just going to be, you know, once the Senate passes it on the Senate floor, it's a done deal? Do we know that, Kim?
I believe because it's a rules resolution, it just needs approval in the Senate.
Okay, thank you for clarifying that, and I regret the error. We'll see what happens there on the Senate floor. I want to move on to some other news. I'll first remind listeners that this is Behind the Headlines, featuring Salt Lake Tribune reporters, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to @KCPW. And Kim, I actually want to stay with you and stay at the legislature and talk about the fact that a lawmaker has a proposal to make Juneteenth an official state holiday. This is the 19th of June, a date that commemorates the end of slavery in the United States. Who's behind this proposal? And, you know, I actually thought Juneteenth was already a holiday, but I guess not one that is officially recognized by the state of Utah. Is that correct?
Yeah, so State Representative Sandra Hollins, who is the first Black woman to serve in the Utah legislature, she is sponsoring a bill that would make Juneteenth a state holiday. Currently, it is observed based on a previous bill that she introduced to make it an observed holiday. And last year, President Biden signed into law to make Juneteenth a federal holiday, but you're correct, it's still not a state holiday.
And I said that it commemorates the end of slavery. Can you remind us what it actually, you know, sort of commemorates and where it came from? You have a little bit of the history in your article.
Yeah, so Juneteenth, also known as June 19th, marks a day when Union troops arrived to Texas in the late 1800s or the mid 1800s. And that was more than 2 years after President Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation to tell enslaved African Americans that the Civil War had ended and that they were free.
Okay. As you said, Representative Hollins is the first Black woman to serve in the state legislature. She wants to see this made a state holiday. Did she face any pushback to this proposal, or you know, how's it going for this proposal at the legislature?
So it passed committee this week. Hard to believe it was still this week.
Yeah.
But it passed committee unanimously, and you know, it's actually something that we're seeing on a nationwide level, and also in other state houses where more states are recognizing Juneteenth as a state holiday or debating it. I believe that right now more than 45 states in the U.S. observe it or recognize it in some way.
Does I guess a quick question I have is, would this bill, you know, give Utahns the day off, or at least, I mean, state employees the day off from their job?
Yeah. So as a state holiday, you know, it would give state workers a day off. You know, I don't know how private businesses would implement it yet. But something that's important to know is also that Juneteenth and this debate around Juneteenth is also happening in the wake of, you know, the George Floyd protests that we saw last summer, and to recognize, you know, Black history more.
Yeah. In public commentary, I know that one person from your reporting talked about how long it took for Utah, the state of Utah, to recognize or to officially recognize Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Can you just remind us of that sort of recent history, Kim?
Yeah, so when the U.S. government established MLK Day in the 80s, Utah recognized the holiday as Human Rights Day, and it didn't take until, you know, 15 some years later for this state to officially recognize the day as MLK Day.
Okay. George Pyle, editorial page editor, columnist with the Tribune, you know, making Juneteenth a state holiday. I'll let you expound on that.
Well, just it's one of those things where you just say it's about time. It needs to be done. And yeah, Utah didn't exactly cover itself with glory with the way it handled the Martin Luther King holiday. Just didn't make itself look good. So, yeah, I hope this goes through and is approved.
Great. Kim, anything we're missing from the story that you want to add before we head to a break in the show, our first break?
No.
Okay. Well, there is still more ahead on Behind the Headlines, including the push to prevent state employers from punishing their employees for having medical cannabis cards. This is Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Kim Bohorquez, Bethany Rogers, and editorial page editor and columnist George Pyle. It's our live Friday morning Utah News wrap-up, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255 or by tweeting them to @KCPW. Bethany Rogers, government reporter with the Tribune, will bring you into the conversation now, and medical cannabis is legal in Utah, but being a medical cannabis patient is not necessarily free of consequences here in the state. We've heard about this before, and you know, you might be prescribed medical cannabis by your doctor. It might be helping with a specific medical condition, but again, some consequences might follow despite the legality and helpfulness of your prescription. You've got some examples of this in your story, and can we maybe zero in on one of those examples? You mentioned a mother of three, a firefighter, a nursing student. Yeah, let's maybe talk about the experience of the nursing student to begin with, a woman named Tisha Emery. Can you tell us a little bit of her story, Bethany?
Yeah, so she is a medical cannabis patient who says that she because of some chronic health conditions. Her doctor prescribed her medical cannabis to try. She had been on a whole range of medications prior to that. And she said that she felt medical cannabis kind of really gave her life back. She was able to go out and play with her kids again. She was able to get off of all of her other medications. She said that she had to just keep on going on more and more and more different types of treatments just to feel like a human again. But with medical cannabis, she was really able to replace all of that and had the energy to go and do other things. She was, as I said, a mom. She is also, I believe, working more than one job, I think two jobs. And she also decided that she wanted to pursue her dream of becoming a nurse. In particular, she wanted to become a flight nurse and be a nurse who helps out with patients who are being airlifted to the hospital. So she enrolled in nursing school and was very transparent about the fact that she was a medical cannabis card holder from the beginning. And didn't have any trouble with that for the first year of her coursework until the point where she it was time for her to begin her clinicals or sort of the practical aspect, the hands-on aspect of actually working in a clinical or hospital setting and getting practical experience. And before she was going to start that, she was given a drug test. You know, the cannabis, obviously the THC showed up in her system. She thought it was going to be no problem. Initially, her correspondence with her school, they just said, okay, you know, send us a copy of your patient card and everything will be fine. But ultimately, her dean said, sorry, we can't accept you into your clinicals until you can pass a drug test. And so she ultimately decided that she wouldn't be able to continue with the program and had to pull out. She said that that's what a difference the medical cannabis had made in her life. She really wasn't willing to give it up even for her nursing program.
Yeah. And so, yeah, as you said, she chose to unenroll from this program. She didn't want to name the program in your article. I don't think we're going to be able to get through all of your examples in this story, Bethany, but one that I think as we move away from her story, one example that I think leads us into another part of your reporting, which is legislation that I want to get to as well, is the story of a firefighter, Levi Coleman. Maybe you can just remind listeners of his story.
Yeah, so he had a somewhat similar situation. He had worked in the Ogden Fire Department for about a decade, I believe, suffering from chronic back pain that whole time, and eventually was also recommended to try cannabis by his doctor. He was transparent about it, came to his boss, you know, said, I have gotten this card. And basically they immediately put him on suspension and said, you can't come back until you hand over your card. He refused. And instead of complying, he sued the city over his right to be a medical cannabis card holder.
Right. Levi Coleman is again, a public employee. He's employed by a city, and that's an entity that is an official entity, I guess, a public entity. And there's a measure at the legislature that is kind of, I guess, based on his experience. Can you tell us, this is a bill that would clarify things for people just like Levi Coleman? Can you tell us what it would do?
Yeah. So essentially, the city of Ogden was putting Levi Coleman on suspension, not because any cannabis had shown up in his system or he failed a drug test, or even because the city had any concrete proof that he was actually using cannabis, but just because by virtue of the fact that he was a cannabis cardholder. The Utah law, state law, had already told public employers that they couldn't discriminate against employees who are using medical cannabis as a treatment, but it didn't say anything specifically about being a cardholder. So the state legislature, state lawmakers said they felt like they had covered their bases, but after Levi Coleman's example, they felt like they needed to clarify in the law that you can't discriminate against someone for using medical cannabis as a treatment or for even having a medical cannabis card.
Okay. And this is what that would do. It would clarify things on that public employer side, meaning this measure would say, this is Daniel Thatcher's measure. I'm sorry, I'm getting lost here, but it would say you can't punish them for holding that medical cannabis card. It doesn't do that for the private sector side of things, right, Bethany?
Yeah, it would only apply to government employees.
Okay. There's a lot of nuance in your story, and I'm afraid that we're not going to get to all of it. One person you feature a lot is Desiree Hennessy of Utah Patients Coalition, who is sort of a resource for the people that you interviewed in this story. Can you tell us a little bit about her and what her group does, Utah Patients Coalition?
Yeah, so she was among the people who got involved right at the beginning of Utah's medical cannabis program, collecting signatures and trying to get Proposition 2 on the ballot, which, you know, was kind of responsible for creating Utah's medical cannabis program, although the legislature then came back in and redesigned the program on their own. But she's really been with it from the beginning. She has a child who experiences severe health issues and has been really significantly helped by medical cannabis. That was kind of her impetus for getting involved in the first place. And for the last couple of years, she served as executive director of the Utah Patients Coalition, which was the group, the main group behind Proposition 2. And after Utah's medical cannabis program was created, it's now sort of, advocating for patients with some of these different situations where they're facing consequences, and then also advocating at the Utah legislature for laws that would benefit medical cannabis patients.
Okay. Yeah, and Bethany, again, I'm sorry to kind of cut you short on this, but our time is limited. I want to bring in George Pyle. Well, actually, first, Bethany, where is Daniel Thatcher's measure? Is it making progress?
Yeah, it's passed through the legislature and it's on the governor's desk now.
Great, thank you. George Pyle, medicine, recognized as medicine, something that is seen as much less addictive and, in fact, much less dangerous than opioids, but when used as medicine, as prescribed by a doctor, it is still, in some arenas, causing it's being treated, other than a legal medicine. Maybe, what do you think's going on here? I mean, there's the public sector holding a medical marijuana card versus private sector complication here. But what do you think of all of this?
Well, it's just taken a long time. I mean, first there was the petition, then there was the voter referendum, which passed. Then there was a legislature that can't resist pushing back on voter referendums and doing it a different way, but they finally did that. And so now we have this system in place. And with the proper medical screening, it is legal in Utah to use medical cannabis when prescribed by a doctor. And if it's legal, it should be legal. And unless an employer can show that a person is somehow impaired, that they're unable to perform their duties because of that, and in none of these cases has anybody even alleged that, as far as I can tell, what the law is should be what the law says. And I think the legislature is right to go ahead and do this. I expect the governor will sign it. He signs just about everything you put in front of him. And it should go forward. And this is just public employees, and it makes sense the legislature would start there, because when it's a state law, the first people you would expect to abide by the state law are public agencies.
You mentioned that it's the state law. Federally, of course, it's more complicated. It's a tough quandary as a result. This is still illegal at the federal level, and Bethany's story addresses that. Bethany, actually, I want to get to another piece of your reporting before we head to another break in the show, and so I'm going to move us on. And this is a different, ambit altogether, a different reporting beat. You reported this week that homeless advocates are calling for a specific shelter to help the elderly and infirm. There are challenges there. Maybe you can tell us how this need was identified and who is making this push.
So providers say that they've long recognized you know, had in the back of their minds the need for some sort of specific shelter for older people, people with severe medical conditions. But that was really brought to the forefront by the COVID pandemic, when not only were these individuals, you know, sort of uncomfortable in a congregate setting, but also really at risk of severe illness and hospitalization and even death by being in a crowded space with a bunch of other people and being at risk of a communicable disease. So, so they identified the need for it really through COVID and have been doing things throughout the pandemic to try to provide safe, separate spaces for people like that.
Your story features some people who are homeless. In fact, it begins with a 63-year-old man named Rudy, who has a hernia and kidney and liver problems, and also with his wife, who has cancer. They are currently being, they're currently being provided shelter, right? But not for much longer. Maybe you can tell us how their story fits into this, into all of this, Bethany.
So actually, he's in permanent supportive housing right now in the Magnolia, but he kind of fit into this because early on in the pandemic, he was one of the first people who was placed in sort of the, they called it the high needs hotel. They, you know, have the three main shelter spaces in Salt Lake County that are congregate. And then they had chosen a hotel where they would shelter people who have these medical needs and who are older in, you know, separate rooms. And so Rudy and his wife were among the group that was able to stay there and really appreciated being able to be separated out from everybody else and have some privacy, be able to be together, but also, you know, be able to be protected from just constantly coming into contact with other people. During the early days of the pandemic.
And again, they are, this is the Magnolia is, as you described it, permanent supportive housing. I want to talk about what that is, but maybe first you can talk a little bit about the kind of money that is being proposed for homeless services at this year's legislative session, including permanent supportive housing.
Yeah, so Governor Cox's budget proposed setting aside $228 million for affordable housing and homelessness. So $128 million of that, I believe, is set aside for deeply affordable housing and homelessness in general. I think that would also go towards like the permanent supportive housing projects, such as the Magnolia, which are spaces that provide services on site and, you know, deeply subsidized housing. And then another $100 million for affordable housing is in the budget. So advocates are really seeing that as a key piece of addressing some of the region's needs this year. They say it's not the only, you know, that this will require continuing annual investment from the legislature, but that would be a good start for this year.
And can I just ask, is that budget, are those funds, are they approved? Are they part of the budget that the legislature is advancing?
So the legislature is still preparing its budget. We don't have any final numbers, but, you know, advocates say that they're hopeful that they'll be able to get some of that funding from the state ultimately.
Okay. Well, it's a really interesting story. I'm going to bring George Pyle into the conversation here just to talk about, George, the sort of overarching need of shelter space that is specific to people who are older and who are infirm, that advocates in Bethany's article are saying is needed. Another part of the story that we didn't get to is, will any community want it near them? I mean, one of the problems with building shelters has been this not in my backyard sort of attitude. Maybe you want to talk about that as well, George.
Well, it's just that every time we take a step to try and deal with this, we just find out that there are more things that need to be done. It starts with so many low-wage jobs. It starts with so many high-rent apartments. There just aren't affordable places to live for so many people unless the government steps up and provides it in some way, funds it or converts a hotel into shelter for the homeless. And yeah, you do have the not in my backyard attitude from a lot of people, but it does seem like when you're talking about homeless people who are ill, who can barely walk, it's not like you're going to have this crowd of people sitting in your front yard, because that's the opposite of what they need. They need shelter, and they need to be somewhere where they can be taken care of, and we should be providing this.
Bethany, I'm going to come back to you just really quickly. There's the temporary shelter that was opened this winter here in on Salt Lake City's west side. What about, you know, whether or not there is permanent shelter that will come online in the future? I mean, I know that some of the advocates are saying we'll start pushing for this, or we're hoping to get something together by the summer. Is there a plan for replacing that temporary winter overflow shelter with something more permanent in the works?
So the Salt Lake Valley Coalition to End Homelessness is actively looking for sites where a permanent shelter for elderly or ill people could go. But they say that, you know, you referenced some of the local opposition earlier. I think it's worth pointing out Salt Lake City currently has a 6-month moratorium in place on additional permanent shelters. So, you know, they're looking for places outside of Salt Lake City, and at this point having a hard time finding anywhere where there would be local buy-in for something like that.
Okay. Bethany, thank you for your reporting on this. I will, or is there anything we're missing from this story that you want to add before we move on to some other reporting from this past week?
Well, I would just add that Jean Hill with the Coalition to End Homelessness said that because of that local pushback, it might actually require the state to step in and do something more forceful to require local communities to be willing to contribute here. And she said there's nothing active going on with that at the legislature, but it's something that she's concerned. It might come down to that.
Yeah, I wonder also if there would be an appetite from lawmakers to do something along those lines. And I guess that's yet to be seen. Bethany Rogers is government reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune, and thank you for your reporting on this. Kim Bohorquez, I want to come back to you actually and stay with a story that is connected to the legislature, having to do with community health workers in the state of Utah. There's a proposal that would give them a kind of not recognition, but formal status in the state. Can you tell us what a community health worker is? And yeah, tell us about this proposal as well, Kim.
Yeah, so community health workers work on the front lines of their own communities to deliver critical health information or resources, oftentimes to diverse communities that are often not reached by traditional medical institutions or doctors. And Senator Luz Escamilla is sponsoring a bill that would create a state certification process for community health workers under the Utah Department of Health.
And what would that do for them? I mean, basically, it would give them a sort of official recognition, but how does that benefit the sort of community of community health workers? And how many are there here in the state of Utah, I guess, is another question.
You know, I'm not sure how many there are, just because a lot of community health workers, don't get paid. They often do volunteer work, or they are grant funded through other medical institutions. But Escamilla, during a committee hearing, said that this bill would help unlock Medicaid dollars to fund the work that community health workers do in their communities, and it would also, in a way, boost that workforce and make the process a little bit more formal for community health workers to pursue this as a career.
You know, you, as part of your reporting, I think you went and visited some community health workers in the Rose Park neighborhood here in Salt Lake City. And I'm wondering if you can just tell us a tiny bit about what you saw them doing, what the work they were doing was, because I think it's still sort of maybe vague to listeners about exactly how they're engaged in their community and what kind of work they're doing.
Yeah, so I had the opportunity last week to follow a community health worker in the morning. I joined her as she was about to deliver a COVID-19 kit to a family living in Rose Park. That family had somebody in their family that had suspected that they had contracted the virus, but didn't really have a way to get to the testing site. So they called Nisi for help, and she ended up delivering a kit that included a thermometer, some N95 masks, a rapid at-home COVID-19 testing kit, and she was able to deliver it to their home outside. And it kind of shows that, you know, they are, whereas medical institutions will oftentimes have people come to them, the work that community health workers do is that they go to where the people are at and give them the necessary resources to be healthy.
Yeah, and often more plugged into the specific community than those health workers may be. It's a really interesting story. I'm going to have listeners check it out at sltrib.com. Kim, I'm sorry, we're going to have to leave it at that just in the interest of time. But yeah, sltrib.com is where you can find Kim Bohorquez's story entitled From Opioid Addiction to COVID-19 Cases, How Community Health Workers Are Responding to Utah's Health Crises. We are going to take another break in the show. There is still more ahead, including our underplayed stories of the week and a conversation with Olympics reporter Julie Jagg. Stay with us. This is Behind the Headlines. We'll be right back.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Kim Bohorquez and Bethany Rogers, and by editorial page editor and columnist George Pyle. This is our Friday morning Utah News Roundup, heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, and again featuring reporting from the pages of the Tribune. Well, to save time for a segment with Olympics reporter Julie Jagg from Beijing, we're going to have to forego some of the great reporting I wanted to get to from my guests. And already turn to our underplayed stories of the week, a segment that George Pyle has for years been hinting at needs to be renamed. So, George, why don't I give you first dibs here? What's your pick for underplayed story, or whatever you want to call it?
Yeah, this is, in case you missed it, just go to Salt Lake Tribune and look under Brian Maffley for the stories he's been doing. There's a bill that had been supposedly dealing with whether you had to do emissions inspections on old cars. They've amended it to allow money from mineral royalties to be put into a highway through the Book Cliffs, which is a really bad idea. And another example of how the state likes to take money from mineral royalties that are supposed to be used to clean up the mess left by mining and put it into more mining, which is exactly the opposite of what they're supposed to be doing. And this, you need to watch these guys every minute. Brian and our other reporters do a really good job of that. So you need to stay on to the Tribune website and watch what they're doing.
Thank you for that pick, George Pyle. Let's go to Kim Bohorquez. How about your pick? For underplayed story of the week.
My colleague Robert Gerke mentioned this last week, but I think it's worth repeating. Currently, UTA is offering free rides for the month of February to fight vehicle emissions.
That's a great pick, I think you're kind of voting for transit when you travel on UTA this month for free. Bethany Rogers, a quick pick from you for underplayed story of the week.
Yeah, we had a fun story earlier this week just about how vinyl records have made a comeback and how Utah record stores say it's like a frenzy of sales at this point.
That is a great pick, and check it out at sltrib.com. I enjoyed that as well. I will have to say goodbye to our guests, George Pyle, Bethany Rogers, and Kim Bohorquez, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for joining us on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Now on the show, we are going to turn to Julie Jagg, Olympics reporter. And when I spoke to her last night, she had just come from a press conference with figure skater Nathan Chen. Take a listen. Julie Jagg, Salt Lake Tribune Olympics and Enterprise reporter, thank you for joining us all the way from Beijing. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, it's exciting to see some hometown people.
So you were there, you know, you're covering a number of Olympic athletes from Utah. But at the present moment, everyone, and not just in Utah, is focused on Nathan Chen. He is bringing home a gold medal. And just what was it like to witness the performances that many of us saw, you know, on television? What was it like to see them there up close, Julie? And how did it feel?
It was amazing, really. I mean, that first one, the short skate, that was the one everything was riding on, right? I mean, that was, there's so much, you could just feel like the tension kind of reverberating there. And this is in a, you know, in a arena in which there are very few people. It's mostly media who aren't cheering. And then there's some Chinese groups that they've been bringing in as fans, but I don't think they're supposed to vocally cheer. And they kind of just wave the flag wave their flags all the time. So, you know, there's not a lot of atmosphere, but you knew it was this big moment, and it's just holding your breath on every jump, just seeing if he was going to get through it.
Yeah. And he did. I mean, there's, I guess we could talk about everything that he's done, but in your reporting, you talk about how his success at these Olympics is kind of a vindication. Well, kind of, it is a vindication for Chen because of his history in the Olympics. And maybe you can just kind of remind us of that history and why so much was riding on that particular event, whose name
right.
I'm forgetting.
The short yeah. skate. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, so when he did it in the men's program a couple days ago, I mean, that was the second time he'd done it at these Olympics. He also performed that at the team event. And so that kind of eased him into it, because in 2018 in Pyeongchang, you know, he was just 18, and I think he kind of had the weight of the world on his shoulders, skating that, and really felt like he was kind of in a different mindset, and the pressure got to him. He hadn't buckled for years, and all of a sudden, one skate, he just couldn't land a jump, was all over the floor, and it just went from first place to, you know, for my favorite, I should say, to disaster, basically. Ended up 17th in that program, which he had an amazing free skate, you know, in the second day, but even that amazing free skate could only take him back to fifth. I mean, he had buried himself so far in the standings. And then on top of that, I mean, he's just been asked about that ad nauseum for, you know, in the last 4 years. It's just, that's all anybody wants to know about. So to see him perform that short program, just, I mean, it was just, he just floated in the air, and you knew then that it was going to be really hard to take him down in the long program. And so it was almost like the long program was an encore, and it's such a fun program because you have the Elton John music and like the kind of popping and locking. And so, I mean, you were kind of like, well, he can't mess up, you know, like if he takes any too big of spills, he's going to be in trouble. But for the most part, the skaters before him had some troubles, so nobody had really put up a high bar, and he just owned the show.
Yeah, he owned the show, and I'm sure that the pressure was kind of off. You know, I mean, he could shine because of the fact that he didn't have any of those pressures weighing on him any longer because of his amazing short program. I know that you know, family, and in fact many spectators, as you pointed out, are not allowed to attend these Olympics. Chen's mom, she is from Beijing. She's not there, though. She's watching from the U.S., correct?
From what I understand, yeah. I think with family in San Francisco, maybe. I'm not sure. I'm supposed to talk to her in the coming days, so we'll find out how it was for her. But yeah, I mean, she's been with him rinkside, like lives with him, like been side by side for the last, how many years has it been since he moved out to California? Or yeah, since 2012. So, you know, last 10 years. It's had to be really hard for her not to be there.
This is maybe a throwaway, but why is he so good? I mean, none of us are Olympic athletes, or I'm not an Olympic athlete anyway, and we know that they are of a different caliber, but he, you know, Chen is kind of in a league of his own. How did that come to pass? How did he get so good?
I think there's a few things. One, from everyone that I've spoken to, he was just like a prodigy, right? From age three, he was doing things. Other kids were falling on the ice and he was making turns, you know? I mean, so natural ability definitely was there. Also, he was the one that made the call when he was 11, when they were making these drives out to go see Rafaela Kurian. He was the one that said, hey, I'm not going to get any better if I live in Salt Lake City and I'm not here all the time. So I need to be here. So, I mean, to make that a decision at 11 is pretty big. And then also, I mean, and I just think he's just, the article I wrote today and kind of something that the coach had mentioned last night was, you know, just their dedication that they slept in the car and they just scraped together money to do this. And it was just really what they wanted. And then also, I mean, he just has artistry and athleticism. I mean, he can do these big jumps, but he also, the thing he really brings that you can see with the other skaters is that he just really emotes well on the ice. You know, you can feel the emotion with him. And I think that's really kind of part, I mean, he's known for his quads, but I really feel like that's a big part of what sets him apart.
You know, you mentioned the fact that this is just sort of a funny side note, but that Elton John's, you know, he was skating to Elton John's Rocket Man during his free skate. And I know that, you know, Sir Elton John congratulated him after that. I found that amusing. I know you attended a press conference with Nathan Chen just now. How is he taking it all in, Julie?
I mean, obviously, big accomplishment. I'm very excited. I think he's still, there's still some shock there. I mean, to see him at the press conference, I think he's just like, okay, you know, I've got these media obligations and things to get through. And I don't think it's really gotten to sit in for him yet. So it'll be interesting to talk to him in like a week or so and see just what he's feeling then, because right before him was Jason Brown, his teammate, and Jason's very, you know, kind of emotional, more emotional guy. And he was talking about just like, when you're done, it's just like things stop, right? And all of a sudden you're like, what am I doing? And for Nathan, it didn't seem like that. And I think it's just because he's still got a full plate. He's got lots of stuff he's doing. He's going to be skating in the exhibition at the end of the Olympics. And so, yeah, he's just one thing after another still.
Still focused. Can you, I guess, the sort of general vibe of the Beijing Olympics so far, I think that you have covered other Olympic Games, Julie, if I'm not mistaken. And,
Yep. You
know, we get some glimpses of what the kind of overall vibe is like watching on television, but you are there. How does this compare to those other Olympics that you have been at? I mean, it's notable, I guess, because of the fact that it's a pandemic Olympics.
Yeah, you know, they've done a nice job, but it is strange. It's just, I mean, it's nice. I'm so glad they're bringing in groups of people. I'm not sure where these people are coming from or how they're bringing them in, but you know, it does add some atmosphere, which is really nice. And especially when the Chinese skaters or Chinese athletes are performing. But in general, it has felt very pretty much sterile, right? Like it's really hard. They're big venues, and it's hard to get a lot of energy going. Because normally at the Olympics, it's all about feels and emotion and kind of just the electricity in the air. And this is not quite like that. The only place actually that I did feel that was I went out to Big Air, and the Big Air venue is weird and cool, and there was definitely that electricity there.
Hey, can I ask where are we talking to you right now? Like, what is the room you are in? Where, you know, we're hearing some atmosphere. What is the place?
Oh, sorry. So I am in the main media center. This is up in the lounge part of it, I guess. And so it's just like a collection of chairs and kind of places to rest. But yeah, down below is one area. There's all the broadcasting people, and then down below is a media work area. And they do press conferences and all of that. So, and this is where all the buses leave from.
You know, I don't want to let you go before asking you a couple of other questions. I know there are other stories that you are following besides the Nathan Chen story. And one that I don't want to leave out is the kind of whirlwind saga of Casey Dawson and his Olympic appearance. It didn't go great, but the backstory is just kind of nuts. Can you sort of tell us the Casey Dawson story, Julie?
Sure. Yeah. So Casey is, you know, a Park City kid, which makes it especially cool that he's not just out here to train. Like, this is Salt Lake area is kind of where he's from. But so he tested positive for COVID in mid-January, right after the trials in Milwaukee, and had recovered in time to be able to come to the Olympics. But one of the what the athletes have to go through, and what anybody has to go through in order to come in, I guess, if you've tested positive, is you have to have 4 negative tests on, you know, consecutive days. So he just said that he would just test and test because he'd get some false positives, and that would kind of throw a wrench into the system. And I guess the lab, which is the same lab that I went through that I also had problems with, that had been approved by Beijing to. It was one of there are only 2 approved labs in Utah that you can get a test through that Beijing approves. And that lab then apparently was disapproved after the games started, or as he was trying to get out here. So he was down to 1 lab, and all those tests that he'd taken at the other place didn't work. Anyway, long story short, he finally got through and then just took a flight from Salt Lake to Atlanta and a red eye from Atlanta to Paris, and then a red eye from Paris to Beijing to get here the morning before what would have been his second skate. He missed his first skate, 5,000, was skating the second skate that 1000.
Speed skating, we should say.
Speed skating, yes, long track speed skating. And but he arrived, but his gear did not. So he had packed a bodysuit, you know, a racing suit in his carry-on, but he can't pack his skates because, you know, sharp object. And they had did not show up. And so he had to borrow a pair of skates from another skater. And talking to some of the other skaters, they were just like, that is, it's not just interchangeable. You know, like, first of all, you have a certain setup. And even if someone has the same setup, like one guy was telling us, he's like, I have three pairs of skates and I only use one of them. And they're all exactly the same. But he's like, because the others just feel slightly different. But to Casey's credit, you know, he didn't take last. He took second to last. But, you know, for all that he'd been through, it was pretty impressive. And the big thing is he still has a big event to go, the event that he wasn't really expected to medal in any other events, but he might have a chance to medal in Team Pursuit, where he's skating with Joey Mantia and Emery Lehman. So hopefully.
Hopefully his skates arrive by the time he's doing that. I guess as of right now, as far as you know, they haven't shown up.
As far as I know, they haven't. I haven't checked in recently, but I'll have to check in and see.
Julie, I'm really grateful for you making time for this. How much longer are you going to be in Beijing? Through the closing ceremony? You know, the whole shebang?
Yeah, through the closing ceremony and then heading back home via Zurich. So it's going to be a 30-hour flight or something to get back. But I'm looking forward to getting back. I'm also, you know, it seems like the time here is just flying by.
Okay. Well, thank you for your coverage. Thanks for making time for this. And maybe we'll try and check in with you again before you leave.
Sounds good.
Julie Jagg's Olympic coverage and everything else that we've been discussing on the show today can be found at sltrib.com. That does it for our show. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for spending the hour with us. Join us again next week.